Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Lord of the Rings AMA podcast. My name is Matthias Austin, and on this podcast, I invite you to ask me anything about Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, or anything related to the greater legendarium of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I will do my best to give you as in-depth an answer as I can. And I do want to thank everyone who answered the call out last week and sent in questions. You've bought me a few more weeks of material. Now, this week is going to be a little bit different, as it's going to be a mailbag episode. These are a collection of questions I've received that don't have enough background or context to fill out a whole full 30-minute episode, 25, 30 minutes, but the answers are interesting enough that I want to talk about them. And as you'll see, they're not all just related to that deep lore of Tolkien's world, so it's a fun mix of stuff. And if you're inspired by any of these questions to submit a question of your own, feel free to email in to lotramapod@gmail.com, and you might make the next batch, or possibly the next full-length episode. So, send what you got. Now let's get started. The first question comes to us from Judah in Warrenville. Judah asks, who is Saruman? Why did he turn evil? How did he figure out how to create the Uruk-hai? Why was he the head of the White Council if he was going to be evil? Now thank you for those questions, Judah. And I had really hoped to make this a full-length episode, but even if I add in all of the background Tolkien wrote about all of the wizards, he just didn't write enough. So I'm going to tell you all the information I could find about Saruman, and I'll add in a few tidbits about the other wizards along the way. Now, most of this comes from the posthumously released Unfinished Tales, a collection of unfinished tales published in 1980 by Christopher Tolkien, where J.R.R. Tolkien expanded on stories and background information of his legendarium. And in Unfinished Tales, he tells us that Saruman is one of the Istari, which Istari translates to wizard. It roughly means wise one. Now, all of the Istari, five in total, are actually Maiar, those angelic beings who were incarnated into the bodies of seemingly old men. And they were sent by the Valar to aid the elves and men in the fight against Sauron in the Third Age, roughly the year 1000, though it is possible that some of them came earlier, which we will get to in a little bit. Now, Tolkien says that the Valar were given permission by Iluvatar to do this, so I need to correct myself. In past episodes, I said Iluvatar directly intervened in the affairs of Middle-earth three times: the creation of dwarves, during the story of Beren and Lúthien, and in the destruction of Numenor. But it does seem that the arrival of the wizards was only done with his permission. And of course, I was forgetting that Gandalf returning as Gandalf the White was another intervention of Iluvatar. So it's not three times, it's actually five times, and I'm sure that the more I research other questions, I'm going to find more and more things. So it's five for now. Maybe there'll be more. I'll let you know when I find out. Now, going back to the Istari, they were limited in their powers when they took on that physical form. They were limited in their powers, and their mission was only to advise and influence, rather than command and rule. And Saruman was the leader of these Istari, and he was the most powerful. The elves in Valinor called him Curunir, which meant man of craft. And the name Saruman comes from the Rohirrim, but it means the same thing, man of craft. He was a Maia of the Order of Aule, the smith, which would make him related in a way to Sauron, who was also a Maia of Aule. In some versions, though nothing firmly was set in stone with many of these details, Manwë called the Maia together, and he looked for volunteers back in Valinor. He's like, Iluvatar's letting us send people over there to help out. Let me gather some volunteers. He calls all the Maia together. He says, all right, listen, I need volunteers. Who wants to go on this mission? And Christopher Tolkien, he found a note that J.R.R. Tolkien had written that said, when Manwë called this meeting, only two Maia came forward. Curumo, which is also, I think I said Curunir before. Tolkien kind of changed the names around a lot, depending on, sometimes it was Curumo, sometimes it was Curunir. Basically the same thing, Saruman. So Curumo was chosen by Aule. Another one that stepped forward and volunteered was a Maia named Alitar, who was sent by Orome, Now then, Manwë looked around at all the Maia, and he goes, "Hey, where is Olorin?" And Olorin, who was clad in gray, he had just come back from a journey, and he was seated at the very edge of the council. He said, "Manwë, yeah, I'm here. What would you like?" And Manwë replied that he wanted Olorin to go as the third messenger to Middle-earth. And it's marked in, like, parentheses in that note that Olorin was a lover of the Eldar that remained in Middle-earth. So that is seems to explain why Manwë wanted him to go. But Olorin, he said, "No, Manwë, I'm sorry. I'm too weak for this task, and I'm afraid of Sauron." And then Manwë said that was all the more reason why he should go, and that he commanded Olorin, and then there's, like, illegible words that follow that seem to say the word third. Varda then, Manwë's wife, queen of the Valar, looked up and he said, "No, he's not the third." And Kurumo remembered that. And the note ends with the statement that Kurumo, Saruman, took Iwendil, which is also Radagast, because Yavanna begged him, and that Alatar took Palando as a friend. Okay. I keep saying this, but if any of that sounds like gibberish, you really do need to go back and listen to episode 3, which is about the creation mythology of Middle-earth. It talks about who all the Valar are and what their relationship are to one another. Yavanna is Aule's wife. It says that Yavanna's begging him to take her Maia with, which is this Iwendil or Radagast. And so Saruman the White took Radagast the Brown as Aule's concession to his wife, Yavanna. And maybe he was trying to make up for that whole creating the dwarfs without her thing. See the episode on Where Do Dwarfs Come From for more info on that. And Olorin, which was Gandalf the Grey, was added at the direct request of Manwë, the king of the Valar. And then Alatar and Palando were these blue wizards. And Judah, part of why Saruman turned evil can be found right here. He was very prideful, just as Sauron was, and even Aule had tended to be. That something to do with being like a creator and a smith and a crafter, it made them more prideful. And now Saruman was suddenly forced to take with him someone he didn't respect, Radagast, and someone that the Queen of the Valar implied would be the best out of all of them, Gandalf. Now, what happens next, Tolkien, he went back and forth about this. In some versions, Saruman is the first to arrive in Middle-earth, and he goes alone. Sometimes he arrives with Radagast. Sometimes it's with the Blue Wizards, but in most instances, Gandalf arrives last. And when he arrives at the Grey Havens, he's met by Círdan the Shipwright. And Círdan, he's got foresight, he's got that elven sense, and he senses in Gandalf that he's going to be the most important of all of these wizards that have arrived. And he gives Gandalf one of the elven rings, called Narya. And Círdan tells Gandalf, this is the quote here, "Take this ring, master, for your labors will be heavy, but it will support you in the weariness that you have taken upon yourself. For this is the Ring of Fire, and with it you may rekindle hearts in a world that grows chill." Now, unfortunately for Gandalf, it seems that Saruman became aware of this, and it made him even more jealous. And the last straw came when Galadriel formed the White Council, made up of the wise of Middle-earth. People like Elrond, Galadriel, Glorfindel, Saruman, Gandalf, other elven lords. And at that first White Council, they voted for Gandalf to be their leader. But Gandalf refused. And so then they said, "All right, if not, Gandalf, we'll go for Saruman." And his pride was so wounded by this that he never forgave any of them. Things maybe could have gone differently, though possibly not better, had Saruman been the first choice instead of the second. So, okay, he's proud and jealous, which isn't great, but it's not necessarily evil. Now, his mission, as all of the wizards' missions were, was to stop Sauron. And being one of Aule's Maia, he delved into the research of the rings and ring-making and crafting, thinking he could use that knowledge. And in the process, he began to think that he could overthrow Sauron with the help of the One Ring. And that's the same temptation that Gandalf flatly refused when Frodo offered him the ring. so he began to work alone, perhaps knowing what he was doing was wrong and he didn't want other people around, and he asked for control of Orthanc, which is also Isengard. And within Orthanc was one of the Palantir. And we know that he used it to communicate with Sauron. So perhaps in his arrogance he thought, like Denethor did, he would withstand Sauron's influence and use it to spy on him. But in the end, Sauron was able to influence his mind. So that might be how he started to turn evil. And as for how he learned to make the Uruk-hai, remember that he and Sauron were very similar, and they thought alike. Now, it could also be that Sauron gave him instructions through the Palantir. We can't really know for sure, but Peter Jackson in the films does show Sauron giving Saruman the command to build an army. So it's not an unreasonable thought that Sauron actually gave him that knowledge. Now, the last thing I'm going to say on the topics of wizards has to do with our good friends Alitar and Palando, the Blue Wizards. Or should I say Morinatar and Romestamo? You see, Tolkien wrote some notes about two wizards that arrived in the Second Age of Middle-earth, which is thousands of years before Saruman, Gandalf, and Radagast. And he wrote it in that note, he said they traveled into the east to combat Sauron's growing influence. And Tolkien wrote, "They must have had very great influence on the history of the Second Age and the Third Age in weakening and disarraying the forces of the East, who would both in the Second and Third Age otherwise have outnumbered the West." So, okay, was this a rewrite of Alitar and Palando? Or were these like alternative names, much like Saruman and Gandalf were not the original names of Curanir, Curumo, and Olorin? That seems like, most likely, that there were only ever five wizards. So maybe it was just another name for those blue wizards, and then he changed his mind about when they arrived in Middle-earth. So there you go, Judah. That is everything I have about Saruman and my best guesses as to his motives, and a little extra information about the other wizards. Now our next question comes from Abby from Sumner, Washington. Abby asks, "What's the story with Grima Wormtongue? How did he get connected with Saruman and get placed as an advisor to King Théoden, and why does he try to take over the Shire?" Unfortunately, with Grima, there's really very little information about him other than what we read in the books. So here is what we know. He was the son of someone named Galmod, which may be derived from the Old English meaning light-minded and licentious, so it's not like a sterling pedigree. And the name Grima itself comes from the Old English word meaning mask or visor, so it's very appropriate for a spy. And how he became advisor to Théoden, it's never explained, nor is it ever said when he first came in contact with Saruman. My best guess is that the two events could be related. Either Grima was already good at talking and gained the position on his own and then sought out Saruman to aid him, or else he went to Saruman first, and Saruman's known for the magical power of his voice, and Saruman gave him the words to say to become advisor. We don't know. In the books, the effect of Grima's words aren't as magical as in the movies. Like, the exorcism scene is way more visually compelling, but it doesn't quite happen like that in the books. As for why he worked with Saruman, the answer to that is very clear in the books. He wanted Eowyn, and Saruman promised him that he could have her when Rohan was overthrown. It is exceptionally gross, and I'm not even going to use the words love or marriage here. It was just this pure desire for possession. Now, as for your last question about why he tries to take over the Shire, oh, the answer is a simple and tragically fitting one. He didn't want to, but he felt he had nowhere else to go, and so he remained with Saruman despite having come to hate him. Saruman also had come to despise Grima and would emotionally and physically abuse him, and the fate of Grima and Saruman is an example of one of Tolkien's key worldview points, which is that evil, when left to its own devices, will inevitably turn on and defeat itself. Now there's one more place that Tolkien wrote about Grima. In the Unfinished Tales, Tolkien gives us the Nazgul point of view of their search for the Shire in the Fellowship of the Ring. And we're told that they traveled through Rohan, and they met with Saruman to see if he knew anything about this place called the Shire. And at this point, Saruman was betraying just everybody, and he wanted to use the ring on his own to usurp Sauron, so Saruman lied through his teeth, saying that he didn't know where it was, but that they should search for Gandalf. Gandalf had just escaped. The eagles had just picked him up off the top of the tower. And he said, go find Gandalf. Gandalf definitely knows. So they left, and in their search, they ran into who else but Grima Wormtongue, who was on his way to Isengard to report that Gandalf had appeared at Theoden's court and had stolen Shadowfax. And when he was questioned by the Nazgul, he immediately fell to pieces. And he didn't show the same intestinal fortitude of Saruman, probably because he wasn't behind the stone walls of Orthanc, he was just out in the open, and so he told the Nazgul everything he knew, specifically that the Shire was the land of the halflings, and the exact directions on how to get there. Oh, and also Saruman knew all of that stuff I just told you. And the Nazgul found him so pathetic, they decided to just leave him alive, because they figured his quick willingness to betray Saruman was likely gonna resurface at some point in the future. So Grima ended up being a prime mover of world events outside of Rohan. It allowed the Nazgul to arrive in the Shire before Gandalf could return, and it also tipped off Sauron that Saruman had betrayed him. So, yeah, there you go, Abby. That's everything I've got about what Tolkien tells us about the betrayer, Grima Wormtongue. Our next question comes from Lydia from San Diego. Lydia asks, Aragorn is one of the Dúnedain, and also the descendant of Isildur, one of the Númenóreans. What is the relationship between the Dúnedain and the Númenóreans, and also who are the Rangers? Are they also Dúnedain? Okay, now I'm going to say, this question did come in before I did my episode on Aragorn, so I did touch on some of this in that episode, but there's a little more nuance I can give to it now than I was able to give in that episode. The part that I've said before is this. Dúnedain and Númenórean are basically synonymous in the Third Age of Middle-earth, and the Rangers are those Dúnedain / Númenóreans still living in the north after the fall of the kingdoms of Arthedain, Cardolan, and Rúdar. And the difference in the names is simply an etymological one. Dúnedain comes from the Sindarin language, spoken by the majority of elves in Middle-earth, and it combines the words Dún, west, and Adán, men, so West Men or Men of the West. Númenor is of Quenyan origin, which is the language spoken by the Noldor in the First Age, and also all of the elves that still lived across the sea in Valinor. Númenor is a shortened version of the technical name, and forgive my Elvish here, Númenóre, meaning Westland or Westerness. And so while synonymous, since the Quenyan language was dying out in Middle-earth, the common usage was that Númenórean was going to be used for those that were actually physically born in Númenor, while the Dúnedain were those that were descended from those Númenóreans. So, for example, Isildur was Númenórean. He was born in Númenor. His son Valandil was one of the Dúnedain. He was born in Middle-earth. Now, for what it's worth, for much of Numenor's history, the people of Numenor didn't even call themselves Númenórean. As the people of Numenor turned away from the Valar, they phased out the Quenyan language of the elves in favor of their own language, Adunaic, which means language of the West. And in Adunaic, the land was called Anadune, meaning Westerness. So as a fun fact, when Numenor was destroyed, and I'm not going to go into the details of that now, that's an episode for another day, it was renamed, as most things in Tolkien's world were, they've all got a million names, and in the language of Adunaic, Numenor was, after it was destroyed, it was referred to as Akalabeth, which means the downfallen. In Sindarin, it was called Mar Nufalmar, which means the land under the waves, and in Quenyan, it was called Atalante, which also means the downfallen. And if Atalante, a lost island nation that was sunk beneath the seas, sounds kind of like Atlantis, well, this is, according to Tolkien, a complete coincidence. See, the bulk of Quenyan had already been worked out when these stories were written, And as Tolkien wrote in a footnote in a letter to Christopher Bretherton in 1964, he wrote, "It is a curious chance that the stem talat, used in Quenyan for slipping, sliding, falling down, of which atalantiae is a normal noun function, should so much resemble Atlantis, especially since Atlantis was the inspiration for Numenor to begin with." See, Tolkien in his youth had had recurring dreams, which he recounted in that same letter. He said, "This legend or myth or dim memory of some ancient history has always troubled me. In sleep, I had the dreadful dream of the ineluctable, ooh, that's a word I haven't said out loud before. I had the dreadful dream of the ineluctable wave, either coming out of the quiet sea or coming in towering over the green inlands. It still occurs occasionally, though now exercised by writing about it. It always ends by surrender, and I awake gasping out of deep water. I used to draw it or write bad poems about it." So, there we go. So, Dunedain, Numenorean, or even Atalantean, they're all pretty much the same. Our next question is from Ian in Maryland. Ian writes, "Really enjoying the podcast so far. Hey, thanks. Here's my question. What was the initial public and critical reaction to the Silmarillion when it was first published? With the state of modern fandom, it's easy for me to imagine fans having polarized reactions to the book because it was published posthumously or because it's so different from the previous books. Even today, many people, including myself, struggle with the book, at least at first. So how did the public receive the Silmarillion in 1977? Well, thanks, Ian. You are absolutely correct that the Silmarillion has proven a daunting task for many people. I recall that for myself, after reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, which I read right after seeing The Fellowship of the Rings in theaters, I tried to jump right into the Silmarillion, and it just did not stick. I was in eighth grade. If you're not from the United States, eighth grade, it's around like when you're 13 years old. I don't know if you're not familiar with the American educational system, grade eight or whatever you would call it. And it was a bit too much for me at the time. The writing is definitely more dense, the stories are less personal, there really aren't protagonists for much of the book, and there's almost no dialogue. There was an entire chapter that just describes the geography of the land. And it probably wasn't until I had reread The Lord of the Rings four or five times, and I was in college, that I gave it another try, and for some reason, it did stick. Somehow it's become my favorite of Tolkien's works, and I probably reread it annually, whereas the other books are on like a 2 to 3 year schedule. Now, I can't say what made that switch flip for me, and I also don't begrudge anyone for not making it through. If everyone had read it, there probably wouldn't be a need for this podcast, so in many ways it's in my best interests that people don't read it, but I'd say it's worth it if you can push through about the halfway point. It has some of the best stories in the entire Legendarium. Now, as for how it was received at the time, it was definitely a mixed bag, and more often than not, it was just panned. In his review for The Spectator, Christopher Booker wrote this about the Silmarillion. After extolling the virtues of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, he writes, "I must now make an admission, which I had never had to make before in reviewing any book, and hope never to make again, which is that, not for want of trying, I have found the new Tolkien epic, The Silmarillion, literally unreadable." And he went on to say that there is no hint of a real story based on a real hero and a real cast of clearly defined characters as in Lord of the Rings. It is just one long, self-indulgent, pseudo-mythical whiffle, like an unhappy conflation of Snorri Sturluson, Joyce's Ulysses, and the more boring genealogical passages of the Old Testament, and apart from the fact that it will obviously sell 100,000 copies to foolish and bemused Frodolaters like idolaters, but Frodo, it should never have been allowed out of the house. Woof, that is a rough review. So let's try another one from The New Republic, written by L.J. Davis. He concludes in his review like this. "The book is little more than a weak gloss of Tolkien's infinitely more mature later work, and so it should be read, if at all. Indeed, much of the material is included in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings in condensed and more intriguing form. Its publication now, especially when accompanied by such unbridled enthusiasm on the part of the industry, is not only questionable, but is bound to lead many of Tolkien's admirers to grave disappointment. Noble intentions do not necessarily produce a noble work. Perhaps the opposite is more often true than otherwise. A slightly more positive review from Tom Simon reads, "The story of the Silmarillion, then, is exceptionally well-developed, but the treatment, as compressed into a single book without evident source or standpoint in the history of Middle-earth, is far inferior to what it could have been. Tolkien meant to do better, but he lost the mainstream of the work in side channels of history and theology, and his imagination ran dry in its own delta." So yeah, this is all pretty bad, but okay. John Gardner, writing for the New York Times, he wrote this, referring to Tolkien at the beginning here. "Strange man, strange mind. Why would anyone do it, we keep asking as we read? Why create a whole Christian-like religion, a whole new creation myth to set beside those of the Greeks, the Jews, the Northmen, and the rest? Why write a mythic history, a Bible? Nevertheless, he has tried to do just that, and apparently, so Christopher Tolkien tells us, we have more of this mad, in the best sense, enterprise yet to come. Ruminations on the languages of ancient times, theological meditations, more stories. Art, of course, is a way of thinking, a way of mining reality. In the Ring trilogy, Tolkien went after reality through philosophy-laden adventure. In the Silmarillion, for better or for worse, he has sought to mine deeper." So, yeah, mixed bag there. There were some more positive reviews. Writing for the Ottawa Citizen, William Reddy concluded his review this way. "This is a most necessary book. Everyone who has read The Lord of the Rings owes it to himself or herself to possess the Silmarillion, to read it, and to pore over it." And speaking about Christopher Tolkien, who compiled it, he wrote, "He sacrificed a great deal of himself, and we will forever be in his debt." And in Time Magazine, Timothy Foote wrote, "But at its best, Tolkien's posthumous revelation of his private mythology is majestic, a work held so long and so powerfully in the writer's imagination that it overwhelms the reader." Now, that could be good or could be bad, depending on if you want to be overwhelmed. So yeah, while the critics were mixed, leaning negative, commercially, the book was a success. In October of 1977, it topped the New York Times bestsellers list. It sold over 1 million copies in its first year. And as time has gone on, its popularity has grown. And it currently, on Goodreads, holds a 4.03 rating. It's been printed in dozens of languages. Expanded stories from the Silmarillion have been produced, like The Children of Húrin, Beren and Lúthien, and The Fall of Gondolin. They've all been published, driven by interest in the Silmarillion. So I think it's gotten more love with age, but you do need to be prepared to think of it less as a novel and more of like an interesting textbook. I don't know whether that makes it more or less palatable for people, but I will say that if you, like Ian, have struggled with reading it, the new audiobook, recorded by Andy Serkis, it's really tremendous. He does an excellent job bringing to life what could be very dry passages. So if physically reading it has been a chore for you, maybe give that audiobook a shot. Or, you know, just keep sending me questions and I'll try to answer them for you. Now, our last question comes from Hank in Le Centre, Minnesota. Hank asks, "What is the best Secret Santa gift you've ever received, and why is it the first edition a copy of the Silmarillion?" Now, I'm going to point out here, Hank is not a psychic. He is, in fact, my brother-in-law. And a couple of years ago, he got me in our family Secret Santa, and he gave me a hardback first edition that his mom had rescued from, I think it was like a library that was closing down. Now, I don't think I paid attention to anything else I got for Christmas that year. I was just so enamored by this book. And yeah, it's missing its dust jacket, and I've actually been too afraid of damaging it to, like, actually read it. So when I do reread it, I get my old beaten-up dog-eared paperback that I bought in high school, the one that I failed to read the first time. So yes, thank you, Hank, for the gift. It's not the only Tolkien book that took my breath away, though. 2 years ago, my wife, Cassie, got me the new illustrated editions of The Silmarillion, The Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings. And when I opened the front cover of The Silmarillion, I physically got emotional. because on that first cover page there, when you first open it, is a colorized version of one of Tolkien's earliest maps that he drew for the Silmarillion. And unlike some of the other maps that you see in the books that get all tidied up, you could still see where Tolkien would, like, cross out a label and write in a new one. And so seeing Tolkien's actual handwriting on the page, making edits on the work that ultimately was never truly finished, it brought this book to life in a way that it hadn't before. So thank you once again to Judah, Abby, Lydia, Ian, and of course, Hank, for your questions. And if you, like these wonderful people, would like to submit a question, email it in to lotramapod@gmail.com. Yeah, I've really enjoyed this mailbag style, so hey, short questions or more in-depth, I'm happy for anything you've got. And don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star rating and review, follow me on Instagram and Threads, I'm at lotramapod on both. Links for all of that is in the show notes. I want to thank, as always, Michael for our music and Lauren for our artwork. And that's all for this week. Iluvatar willing, I'll be back next week. See you then.